Okay, I think we'll get started. My name is Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS, and I want to welcome all of you. I want to first thank our co-organizers on this event, which is the team at Chatham House, Alex Vines and Tom Cargill, who are hanging out in the back there, and the NGO, the International Rescue Committee, which kind of commissioned this report, which is a Chatham House report, and to Eddie Thomas, who I'll introduce in a bit, who authored the report. I think as the report makes very clear, the next 12 months in Sudan are among the countries most crucial in its history. At the end of that period, Southern Sudan will vote in a referendum which could herald the breakup of the nation and the formation of a new independent state. Before that, a tremendous series of obstacles have to be cleared. These include the national elections, which for most Sudanese will present the first chance to vote in their lives. There are referendums also due in Abyei and Darfur and the so-called popular consultations that will take place in the northern states of Blue Nile and southern Kordofan. The border between north and south will have to be demarcated. If the southern referendum results in a vote for secession, and all indications right now are that it will, solutions will have to be found for a whole new set of challenges. How do you divide the national assets and share Sudan's oil wealth and other resources? How do you define citizenship in a new state of southern Sudan? How do you set up a national currency and banking system? What rights of movement will there be across the new international border? And how do you preserve peace between the two nations, particularly in the event of a very contentious split? And in southern Sudan, how do you protect a fledgling state from being undermined by weak institutions, internal power struggles, and fracturing localized violence and corruption? So the challenges are huge, and the time is very short. The report makes clear that there are agreements can be reached that pull Sudan back from the brink. Unfortunately, they will depend on deals struck between elite groups in which the Sudanese public and disenfranchised groups in Darfur and other historically neglected areas may not have much say. In the meantime, U.S. And international attention to these big issues has started late. Last year, about this time, we hosted Eddie and his report, which was one of several at the time. It was called Against the Gathering Storm, which really was a call to refocus international attention back onto the CPA and look at Sudan in a much more comprehensive, holistic way. I think that has happened, but it's happened late. The new administration, the Sudan policy rolled out, replaces that emphasis on the CPA, promises to engage with Sudan, and promises consequences for backsliding or recalcitrance on the part of both parties. Unfortunately, we don't have a clear sense of what the benchmarks are, what the consequences might be, what the realistic leverage we have. But certainly the attention is there now, but it may be somewhat late. And I think this whole period of neglect has taken its toll. The U.S. influence to shape events is probably much less than it might have been in the past 5 years. And right now the partnership and kind of a common consensus with other partner nations is going to be essential. But even then, I think, and the report makes clear, the ability to move things in a positive direction really lies with the Sudanese. And the tendency may be for a series of hurried elite deals to get through the most critical obstacles. And the question that Eddie raises in the report, I think, is how do we support Sudan through this process without reinforcing that gap between the elite and the public? And the Sudanese people. So let me stop that. We've got three terrific speakers today. We have Eddie Thomas, obviously, who's the author of the report, has a PhD in the history of Sudan, and has published extensively on Sudanese politics. He's worked for the UN in Sudan and with UNICEF in Khartoum as a child protection advisor, and he's currently the director of a course on Sudanese history, politics, and society run by the Rift Valley Institute. We have, and I will mangle this name for sure, apologies in advance. Dr. Ake Koch-Ahu-Kok, is that relatively close? Yes. He's the chargé of affaires at the Embassy of the Republic of Sudan, and since September 2008 has been the highest-ranking Sudanese official at the embassy here in Washington, D.C. And then we have the Honorable Ezekiel Lo Gatkwok, head of mission for the government of Southern Sudan to the U.S. and former SPLM rep to Washington. So after that rather long-winded introduction, I'm going to turn over to Eddie. We'll turn to our two fellow panelists for comment and then open up to discussion. Thanks, Eddie, again for being here.
Well, thanks very much to you, Jennifer, for inviting me for this discussion and also for summarizing the issues so clearly for us. I'm now going to give you a less clear and longer summary of the issues, I think. So I apologize in advance. But as Jennifer very ably pointed out, it's a very critical year ahead. The referendum in southern Sudan and Abyei is due in less than 12 months' time. We'll know then if there's a constitutional transition between now and then. We will know if Sudan is to stay united or to be divided. And there's lots of questions that need to be answered in the year ahead. One of the things that I tried to get across in the report, and as Jennifer was pointing out there, I think, is that the challenges of the year ahead are of somewhat different nature to those challenges we had at the start of the comprehensive peace agreement, at the start of the interim period that it charted for the transformation of Sudan and for making the unity of this very divided country an attractive thing for all of its citizens. Now, that was back in 2005, where in a burst of activity, we had the formation of a government of southern Sudan. We had, which was financed from oil revenues, shared out according to a pre-agreed formula, and we had a representation at the heart of the state for a group of people that had been historically very much excluded from the state, the southern Sudanese. So there was restructuring at the centre and a new institution or set of institutions in the south, and there was a lot of hope around as well. One of the things about those deals, those arrangements at the beginning of this period, was that they were arrangements that could be concluded by the two parties relatively easily. The two parties, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the former rebels based in the south, and the National Congress Party, an alliance of Islamists and finance and security interests based in the north. They both shared the combination of audacity and pragmatism that allows opposing generals to sit together in a cabinet and divide up the wealth of the country between themselves and establish state institutions. Now, what the challenges of the year ahead are a bit different in my view, because they require sustained engagement with populations. What are those challenges? Well, two of the big ones that I want to talk about, there are lots of them. There's lots and lots of processes, and Jennifer has already gone through some of them. But two of the big ones are the borders, drawing a border between North and South Sudan, which is an indispensable condition of a referendum on self-determination. You have to decide what is the territory that can determine its own future. And also the elections. The elections are about listening to people. I mean, they may be, many people have been saying that they are likely to be flawed elections, but whatever kind of elections you have, you have to turn to the voters to some extent. Now, I don't want to anticipate the sovereign decision of southern Sudanese voters, but they have a big decision at the end after 12 months from now, when they decide on the future of the country, whether it's to stay together and stay separate or be separated. And I think there's a lot of arrangements that need to be made before that decision can be taken fairly. And I'd like to just go through what those arrangements would be, both in the case of unity and in the case of separation. Now, if Sudan stays united, the two parties, first and foremost, they need to work out security arrangements. The CPA only has one reference to what will happen at the end of the interim period, and that reference is that within 90 days, the two armies of Sudan, the Sudan People's Liberation Army and the Sudan Armed Forces, the armies of North and South, need to unite. That is an impossibly ambitious timetable, in my view. Those two armies are currently confronting each other, and the four major ceasefire breaches in the last 5 years have occurred when units from the joint integrated units, which are an attempt to bring those two armies together on a small scale, have started fighting within each other. So security is going to be a big issue if Sudan decides to remain united. But there's two other things. One is there are parts of the peace agreement which were never implemented at all. And a really important one, I think, is national reconciliation. The CPA required measures for national reconciliation. It was very vague about what those would be, but it did require that attention be paid to the trauma and the need for people to work out how they got through a very brutal and long war. There's been no progress at all on that. And there's other very, very important parts of the agreement which set out to address the causes of the conflict, which have only been partially implemented. And one very important one there is the need to invest in the development of Sudan's vast and diverse and impoverished peripheries. Unequal development and mismanaged diversity are at the core of Sudan's long crisis. And the possibilities presented by the CPA to address those problems have been, to a certain extent, bucked. Another thing that you would need in the case of unity is reform of the security services in order for Sudanese citizens to enjoy the freedoms that are set out in the constitution. And there's been very patchy progress on that. I think that's probably well known to everybody here. But without that reform, you're not going to get the resolution of the conflicts in Darfur and other troubled northern peripheries. And without action on the other unimplemented or partially implemented areas of the agreement, namely investment in the periphery and reconciliation, you're unlikely to get peace in Darfur. So unity, the unity of Sudan, which was not very attractive to start with, remains a difficult option. But secession is not necessarily all that much easier. As Jennifer was saying, Jennifer enumerated some of the deals that need to be done, the agreements that need to be reached in the next 12 months in order for secession to go ahead smoothly. Agreements on oil revenues, on water, on borders, on nationality, on currency. These are a clutch of issues that are very technically complex, but they also involve the livelihoods and identities of millions of people. They require the parties to listen to and engage with ordinary people if they're going to get them right. I want to just talk very briefly about two of them. Currency. Now, currency, before I started writing this report, I thought it was a terribly technical issue that I didn't really need to detain myself on. But actually, introducing a currency that was at a price that disadvantaged powerful economic interests was one of the sparks for the civil wars in Somaliland and Eritrea in the 1990s, immediately after their secessions were, within two to four years after their secessions. If Sudan is going to be separated, will South Sudan have its own currency, and how will that be priced? Whose interests need to be taken into account when deciding what the value of a Southern Sudanese currency unit is, and what you can buy of northern goods for that? And the second thing is nationality. Now, going back to Eritrea again, Eritrea had a Nationality Act in place before its referendum, I think about 2 years before. So there's a long time for people to reflect and consider and decide on whether they wanted to be Eritreans or they wanted to call themselves Ethiopians. There's no Nationality Act yet. And there's even been some very ferocious threats from the elements within the National Congress Party that if the South secedes, that Southerners will lose their right to Sudanese nationality. nationality and perhaps their rights of work in Northern Sudan. This would create an unimaginable crisis for loads and loads of ordinary people and families. All sorts of horrible separations will be visited on people. And so I think those are two issues, and I don't want to go through all of them because we don't really have time. I want to say that the two parties need to get to work on what the future holds for their country, and I think they need to listen to the past, and they need to listen to the warnings and lessons from the region. But most important of all, they need to listen to and persuade and explain things to their own people. Not listening and not engaging are two of the big risks for the year ahead, because the two parties have got so many technical issues to discuss, and as they turn to face each other for a last hectic round of negotiations, they may turn their backs on their own constituencies and the lessons of the region. They may also neglect lethal local violence across southern Sudan, Darfur and Kordofan. They may bargain away the interests of weaker constituencies for immediate gains. However, there are reasons to expect some kind of move towards popular engagement in the year ahead. And I think one of the things that the international community needs to do is find ways to make the best of them. Elections are a key process, of course. When you conduct elections, you have to communicate with the population. You have to identify constituencies and animate them in some way or other. So that offers one set of possibilities. And the demarcation of the oil-rich and populous and very troubled border between north and south, which intersects so many livelihoods, is also a place where you need to do a lot of explanation, in my view. And I think there has been some explanation here that pastoralists in northern Sudan spend more than half the year in southern Sudan, very often grazing their cattle. There has been some work done to explain to them that they will maintain these rights in the event of secession. But I think much more work needs to be done there. And I think the elections need to be seen as an opportunity to help reorient Sudanese politics away from a very violent kind of politics and towards one which allows political processes to help people articulate and attain their own interests. So finally, a couple more minutes. What's the role of the internationals? Well, I'm not very good on this question. Sudan is a country that values its own sovereignty very highly. It invokes its own sovereignty frequently, but it also internationalizes its problems quite hastily sometimes. And it's also internationally exposed because of the oil price. It's very dependent on oil for its economy, and because of all of these events that are happening outside Sudan, reactions to the terrible violence in Darfur, the indictment of the President of the Republic for war crimes and crimes against humanity there, these all throw some of Sudan's interests out into the international sphere. African countries have a big role. They ran the negotiations that led up to the CPA and the African Union, partly embodied by former President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, is now poised to play a renewed role in the country. The US has a very important role in Sudan. It helped to bring about the CPA in the first place. European countries also signed up to the CPA. And China and India have got big investments there that could make or break the economy. All of these countries, I think, recognize that Sudan has a peace deal that is still working, that the two governments in Juba and Khartoum have averted war for 5 years, and they can do so still. And part of the answer for this lies in oil. Oil mostly lies in the south, extracted from the south, and all of it is piped through the north and sold through the north, and it's the kind of structural reason for peace between the two governments. Now, I think that internationals need to help Sudanese elites to make the best of this structural reason for peace, but they also need to remember that an oil deal is not a peace deal. It's not the same thing. internationals have to support processes that require Sudanese elites to engage with Sudanese people and the region, like the elections and the border demarcation. I think these need to be, from a financial point of view in particular, the elections and the referendum need to be given unstinting support by donors. Supporters of the CPA also need to be alert to the shortcomings in the implementation of important parts of the CPA that deal with the causes of the conflict. Things like reconciliation and action to address the dire regional inequalities in Sudan. That's what a Darfur peace agreement is going to look like. You need to keep working on those issues while working to ensure that the CPA reaches its endpoint safely and peacefully. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Eddie. That was about as long as my introduction. much richer in content. Good. Well, why don't we turn to you first, Dr. Akok, and for brief remarks, and then to Ezekiel, and then we'll have ample time, I think, for comments and questions. Thanks, Eddie.
Oh, thank you very much, CSIS, for the invitation, and Mr. Thomas for the report, which has been very comprehensive, and the remarks that you have just said. I would want to say that at the beginning, the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, SPLM, struggled for unity of the Sudan, but put other options, including separation, as conditions. But that unity was qualified to be based on new conditions. And those conditions included political participation, secularism of the state, socio-economic development, equilibrium between the center and the periphery. And all this appear not to have been fully achieved. So when the government of Sudan and the SPLM came to conclude the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, they also included an item that is a referendum, making unity attractive as one of the conditions. And one of the options for the referendum was to maintain unity, with the other being separation. I believe today, as Jennifer said, most southern Sudanese do not feel that unity has been made attractive, and so they might vote for separation. Most northern Sudanese feel that unity has been made sufficiently attractive, and the south should vote for unity. Unfortunately, well, it's only the southern Sudanese who are going to vote. So it appears that the balance is tilted towards separation. As the government of Sudan, although I'm from the SPLM, we hope unity will be maintained because the world is moving towards globalization. And so it might be in the best interest of everybody to keep unity. But any people who feel disadvantaged have the right to choose their destiny. This President Bashir has confirmed just 2 days ago in Yambio, if it is not a commitment, at least we need to note that he has uttered it. The SPLM is also working for unity in that today the candidate for the presidency is from the north, Yasser Arman. So we are hopeful for a united Sudan, but we should be prepared for all options. For some time, post-referendum arrangements have been or are being negotiated. Our problem in Sudan is that we are not very conscious of time, and I hope I'm not cheating your time. We tend to overshoot so many things and delay and miss deadlines and so many things. So the post-referendum arrangements are being negotiated. I hope many of the difficulties which are being faced or to be faced would be resolved before the referendum. Examples of this missing of deadlines has just been with the passing of the referendum bill. It was until just the last day before the assembly could close that the bill was passed. So I'm hopeful that with the challenges and the risks which are involved, the political leaders would feel the necessity to conclude agreements, arrangements that will prevent a return to violence following the referendum. But I think this is the most we can expect from the international community to help us arrive at these arrangements either before or even soon after, because it is going to be a process. It cannot be finished over time. So we need guidance, accompaniment during, before, during, and after the referendum. I'll keep my remarks to this level, and I'll be willing to answer any questions, any queries when they arise. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Dr. Ezekiel.
Thank you very much. I just came yesterday from Juba, so I might have been having difficulties in sleeping. So don't be surprised if I'm dozing. Thank you very much, Jennifer and Thomas, for inviting us, and also the report was very comprehensive. I will just make some few remarks about the report and also about the CPA. Of course, CPA was meant to address two issues. One of them is to try to make unity attractive, basically to have a new Sudan. The vision of the SPLM is to see that Sudan is transformed into a better Sudan for all of us so that we feel like we are part of this Sudan. Of course, for years, Southern Sudanese felt like they are not part of this Sudan. It was the Sudan that they were not consulted when the independence was given in 1956. Of course, we rebelled in 1955 before even the independence was granted to the people of Sudan. So we were not consulted. So Sudan doesn't belong to the Southern Sudanese. It belongs to some people in the north, and we call them the ruling clique. So the SPLM is trying to address that by having a new Sudan for all. And this is option one, to make unity attractive or have a transformed Sudan. The second one was to also ask the people of Southern Sudan if this new Sudan is good for you so that you can continue to be a part of it through a referendum. So Southern Sudanese has to go and vote for a referendum, in the referendum to see if they are going to be a part of this Sudan. So these are the two issues. The rest are basically formalities, participation in the government of national unity, and also sharing the resources. But basically the CPA is addressing those two issues, trying to see if Sudan can be attractive for Southerners, and also if we don't feel like we are part of it, we can go. So far, as I was telling you, I just came from Juba. The SPLM leadership met. We have nominated Yasser Arman as our candidate for the President of the Republic. This is another way to also try to see if Sudan can be transformed through an SPLM leadership. And if this is not going to work, then definitely the people of Southern Sudan will also go. But to us in the SPLM leadership, it is either way. If Yasser becomes the President of the Republic, we will try to make unity the best option for the people of Southern Sudan. But if they feel like they are not also satisfied with that, then they can choose independence in 2011. But we will have two countries governed by the SPLM. In the north, Yasser Arman will continue to be the new president of the Republic of whatever they will call it, Northern Sudan. And then President Salva Kiir will continue to be the president of the Republic of whatever it will be in 2011. The issue of election is a concern to us. It is very important. Some people are saying that, well, don't talk of a free and fair election. It has to be somehow credible. But I think it is actually very important to make sure that the election is free and fair or credible, if you can combine the two, the three. Because if it is not free and fair or credible, it can be also a very quick way of returning to war. Because if the SPLM felt cheated in the election, then definitely the supporters of the SPLM will come out openly, and it can actually lead into uprising, and it can be very, can be, I don't want to use bloody, but it will be a messy, and we don't want to go into this issue of a very messy election. It is very important for the international community to make sure that this election is monitored and it is supported technically, and also the resources must be provided to make sure that this election is at least credible, so that everybody will be happy and the outcome will be respected. Because there are some concerns that, of course, Bashir wanted to win this election by all means. Day before yesterday, when I left Juba and I arrived yesterday, we were together at the airport. He was going to Yambio, himself and all the leadership of the SPLM. We were together. They were shocked because they were thinking that the SPLM is just going to team up with them, supporting him as the only candidate against all the political parties. Because, of course, he believes that if it is the other political parties running against him, then definitely he will have a landslide victory. But since the SPLM is contesting, definitely he's worried, because if you go to those who are registered as voters, south alone we have actually 15 million people registered to vote. In the south we have 4.6 million people in the south, and definitely these are the base of the SPLM. They will actually vote for the SPLM candidate. And if you look at Darfur, they are almost close to 3 million, and these are all not happy also with the NCP. So you can see Yasser as the best chance to win the election. It is very important for us also. We are moving toward this critical year, as stated by many people. The two parties actually must be, you know, held accountable to the implementation of the CPA. We need to have some benchmarks that are very clear, including the SPLM. If we are dragging our feet on any provisions that need to be implemented, definitely we have to pay the price for it. And if it is NCP, it is very important also to make sure that it is they are held accountable. Election can lead into war. Of course, also the demarcation of the north-south border, it is very important, because as of now, we don't even know the boundaries between the north and the south, and even the states. How can you have election if you don't know your constituencies? we have to demarcate this border before April 11th, 2010, and also before the referendum itself. So we are definitely committed to it, and the technical committee or the ad hoc committee working on the border, they are going to do a presentation next week to the presidency, and hopefully we are going to accept it, their findings. Or if there are some adjustments that need to be made, then definitely we will give them another mandate. But it has to be done before 2010 April. The issue of post-2011 arrangement, said by the Ambassador of Sudan, Ambassador Akej Koj, if the referendum is conducted today, 98% of the people of Southern Sudan are going to vote for separation. I'm 100% sure. Because unity has not been made attractive to them. I just came yesterday. You can see the feelings of the Southerners. They can compromise election. They will say, don't worry about election. But referendum, it is a red line for them. This is what they wanted to see happening in 2011. And this is where they will express their aspirations if they wanted to be part of this Sudan or not. But we are concerned about the linkages between the post-2011 and the law itself, the referendum. These two are so different. They should not be linked together. The referendum can be conducted while we are discussing the post-2011 arrangement. But yes, it is very important for us to have an agreement on the post-2011 arrangement, because if you look at the proposal from the NCP, they are 100% sure that Southern Sudan is going to go. What they wanted to see happening is to have an agreement on how we can continue to share the oil and how we can also divide the assets, because they are not focusing on the asset. They are actually concerned about the debts, because we are owing the World Bank and the IMF $36 billion. So they want to share, even though they were incurred by buying weapons to bomb us. They want us somehow to have some share before we leave. And I stated also by Mr. Thomas the issue of nationality, because in July 9th, 2011, if the people of Southern Sudan are going to vote for separation, as it is the case, then you don't know the response of the North. They might even say, that's it, you are no longer a citizen of the Sudan. You need to go to Southern Sudan, even though you are having your own properties in the north. So there has to be an agreement on how you can handle those difficulties, because I'm sure some people will express their frustration and anger toward the south, because you are leaving the north. So having an agreement on those, it is very important, and also even the water. And even the tribes that are on the borderline, like the Mesiria, definitely they will continue to have access to the south, because their cattle will continue to graze in the south. We need to be helped and supported so that we can have an agreement. The National Congress Party are interested in having just the two parties focusing on this post-2011 arrangement. But to us, as SPLM, it is very important for the international community to help us in this and witness the agreement that we are going to have on the post-2011 arrangement. We don't want to have a gentleman agreement whereby they will just say, okay, let us have an agreement in the House, and then we know how to handle it. We don't need to have Americans or UN or AU or EU in this. But, of course, they are known to cheat. They wanted to have some ways of how they can benefit out of it, because they are talking about the pipeline is going to the north, forgetting that the pipeline is also built using the resources from the south. It is a national asset. It is not, you know, it doesn't belong to the National Congress Party. So it is very important for us to be supported in this post-2011 arrangement. And also, for us, you know, we are having insecurities in the south. We are a new government. Some of us, we've never been into the government before, so our capacity is very weak. And we have been fighting for a long time, in 1955 to 72 and then 83 to 2005. Some of us, we grew up in war. We were born in war and we grew up in war. And we educated ourselves here and there, so we didn't have even a formal education. So we don't know how to run the government. We are trying our best. So our capacity to be built so that in 2011, if Southern Sudan becomes a nation, so it has to be a viable nation so that we will be able to govern and take responsibility. So in terms of security, the police force, and the economy, because if you can have food and you can have a road to transport food to another communities, and then you provide security to your communities, then definitely you will be a viable state. But if you don't have a food, then definitely a hungry man is a hungry man. Definitely you will fight to get food from other communities. That's why you are seeing some people are raiding other communities because they don't have food. So our capacity to be built is very important. The government of Southern Sudan has actually formed a task force, a Southern Sudan referendum task force, to deal with all those issues in terms of referendum post-2011 arrangement and how we can also make sure that we're a viable state in 2011. So I think I will just stop there, and I hope I did not actually take a lot of your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all three of our speakers. Let's open up and maybe take a few questions at a time. Eddie, to you, I mean, if you listen to the challenges there, the time frame is so short for any kind of listening, consultation, or communication. Kind of what kind of strategy do you propose there? I mean, what would that look like, and who would do it?
You noted that I didn't come up with a strategy. Yeah, I think this is a very a year which it's going to be a very full year, and I think that people who run Sudan are going to be very much focused on these really complex historical decisions that need to be taken. At the same time, one of the reasons why Sudan is likely to separate, as Dr. Ezekiel was saying, is because it doesn't seem to work as a country. Unity is not attractive. The state project in Sudan has always had to employ a lot of violence in order to keep things going. So if you have secession, those problems at the heart of the state project in Sudan will be reframed rather than resolved. And I think that the coming year, people need to use the opportunities presented in all of these decision-making processes to orient the state away from violence and towards a more peaceful and consultative approach to its people. Now, I don't know how that can be done. And sometimes when you talk to decision makers, I mean, proposal that some people say is a constitutional convention. And then the question is whether that should happen before the referendum, at which time the SPLM could play a full role in it, or after the referendum, in which case, in the case of secession, the SPLM would have much less sort of authority to talk about what the future of Northern Sudan was like, and vice versa. Many people feel that there's just too much on to discuss, to have a constitutional convention. And then there's also the problem that people in power are very afraid of losing power, and they don't necessarily want to open up to other forces. And there's also the fact that traditional political forces in Sudan are discredited as well. They don't necessarily... or some of them are discredited. They don't necessarily have all the solutions to these problems. So just Sudan has been ruled in such a divisive way for so long that it's very difficult to map out strategies for more inclusive governance. I think in order to answer problems such as security, now security seems like a pressing problem that everybody wants to see progress on, before the referendum. Internationals and national domestic actors as well. But if you're going to address these localized conflicts, how can you do it without investment in the periphery? How can you do it without changing the political order in the periphery? Remember, the periphery was the site and is the site of many wars, and the wars are fought by militarizing local groups, by selecting the most violent youngsters in a local society and empowering them over their elders. And everything gets turned upside down in that process. You know, maybe the elections, I'm not particularly optimistic about the elections at a national level, but the elections will replace all of the appointees, which is every office holder in Sudan practically, all of the appointees will be replaced by elected officials. It's not that they will necessarily be sort of totally committed to peace and transformation, but at least they will have some responsiveness to the people who elected them. So I think those are maybe two areas where people could engage. And I think on the border, people really have to start explaining things, in particular to the northern pastoralists. I very often when I'm speaking to southern Sudanese colleagues and friends, you know, they remember very bitterly the way that those groups were used to conduct the war in the south in the worst of all possible ways, kind of thing. But that to some extent has prevented action on kind of alliance building with those groups or you know, normal politics with those groups. But I think explanation is really important for those groups, because if their livelihoods just get cut off, or if they face an economic crisis as a result of the referendum, there'll be a lot to pay for that.
Thank you. Let's open it up. If you have a specific question for one of our speakers, let us know. Otherwise, we'll just give everybody the opportunity to respond. Yes.
I imagine the fantasy in which
could you introduce yourself? If you could just say who you are and where you're from.
You're from Free National Defense University. I imagine a situation in which the UN gave a permission to Kurdistan or Kashmir to separate from their countries. And this is a one time in human history. One time. That's it. You do it now, it never happens again. They'd be out of there in a heartbeat. And that's the problem with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. It didn't say, let's do this every 10 years. It says, this is your one time, man. So sure, they're going to say, we'll get out of here. We're not going to try it for 10 or 20 years till the next referendum. So it is, I think, a fact on the ground. Some analysts say there's no way Khartoum's going to let this pass. And so I want to ask, what's plan B when Khartoum doesn't let it pass? And also, what happens when Darfur stands up and says, equal treatment, please?
Well, this is going to be a difficult choice. There have been attempts by a number of political leaders from the National Congress Party to delay the referendum to be held in 2016. And this certainly is going against the spirit and letter of the CPA. And if it were to be allowed, probably would have led to renewed violence, early renewed violence. So any postponement or refusal to have it will lead to one other choice, which is provided for by the CPA, and that is the unilateral declaration of independence by Southern Sudan. And it is an option that is very attractive to the South, but also which carries a lot of risk, because the North, as I see it, is unlikely to accept it without a fight. And so it might just be an option of going back to war. But to answer your question, the unilateral declaration of independence would be, in my opinion, what the South would have to resort to. Thank you.
I agree with the ambassador.
Darfur will not demand equal treatment at this time because so far in its program, it is not asking for independence so far. But should the South go, as you correctly pointed out, that option would likely cross the minds of so many leaders in Darfur and may ask for it. But that will be up to the Sudan after 2011 to determine. If this Darfur demands it now, the answer would be no. The answer would be certainly no, because it is not part of her agenda. The negotiations that have been ongoing, either in Africa or now in Doha, do not include an option of separation. So, yes, it is possible. That is, or there are rumors here and there that some factions are considering this so that they can gain more concessions from the North. I hope that is satisfactory, but I don't think I have a complete answer for your question.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Anyone else on that one?
On the question of whether Khartoum will let the referendum pass, I mean, I think there's probably likely to be elements within the National Congress Party who are hostile to the notion of an independent Southern Sudan. There's probably a lot of people who feel, oh no, this is happening on our watch. This, you know, we're going to get the blame for this. And I think it's more an anxiety about that rather than, you know, a hostility to the notion of an independent South. But there's also groups within the NCP who support or who appear to support independence for Southern Sudan and see in it an opportunity to refashion Northern Sudan along the principles of the Islamist Party on which the NCP is based. So I think there's probably my guess is, and I might be completely wrong about this, but there's a plurality of views within the NCP on that. I mean, there is obviously a big risk. There's always big risks in Sudan. Sudan is... Well, I'd agree with the ambassador and with Dr. Ezekiel. Plan B would be unilateral declaration of independence, but that's a very desperate step to take.
And by the international community.
Well, that is why it's a desperate step. That's one of the reasons why it's a desperate step to take. I mean, my understanding is that, and again, I might be wrong, is that the international community would be very reluctant to recognise a non-constitutional transition. And in my view, the government of South Sudan needs to work very hard to secure a constitutional transition or to be clearly the aggrieved party in the case of a non-constitutional transition and to ensure that it has very wide diplomatic backing. I don't know how I can even say this in front of gentlemen like yourselves whose job this is. Maybe you should answer that.
You know, and English is not my first language, but in the CPA, it says the rights of the people of Southern Sudan will be determined through inter alia referendum. I mean, maybe the word inter alia is among other things. I don't know if this is the translation, those who speak English. So, yes, we can determine ourselves through, you know, a referendum, a credible and fair referendum, or through other means in the CPA. That's why Ambassador Akech was saying a unilateral declaration of independence is also one of the things, or the Parliament of Southern Sudan voting on the referendum, or they will actually be asked on behalf of the people of Southern Sudan to decide if they can determine the fate of the Southern Sudanese. Because you can also remember that the independence of the Sudan was actually declared by the parliament, not the Sudanese themselves. So it can be other. There are a lot of options, but I think the two parties are committed, because it is part of the CPA, that the referendum has to be organized and it has to be free and fair and credible, so that the people of Southern Sudan can decide. And this is the best option that we wanted to see happening. But to me personally, yes, all Northern Sudanese, they don't want Southern Sudan to go. That's a very red line for them. And you said it very clearly that some of them, they don't want to be seen responsible for allowing the South to go. Historically, they will be blamed. And this is the end of them. So some of them are trying to also backtrack. But do they have options? That's the question, because they have no options. Whether they like it or not, Southern Sudan is going to go, either violently or peacefully. And these are the two options that they needed to weigh. You know, is it better for them to allow the South to go peacefully so that we can continue to coexist? And this is the thinking of why we have to have post-2011 arrangement, so that we can divorce ourselves peacefully without going to court and hire all those lawyers to take all of our money before we settle down. So the best way is to have this peaceful divorce, so that we can, they call it alimony, so that we can share. But if it is going to be violence, then definitely it is 90% of the oil which is actually being exported to China and Malaysia is from the South. So if it is going to be a violent divorce, you will just say oil is from today and onward, you are not going to get a penny out of it. All the grazing rights for Masseria, they can come to the South. Even the issue of water, Egypt, I'm sure they will go mad also. They will be concerned about it. So I think the international community need to help us in this. But I think at the end of the day, we will have a peaceful divorce.
Thank you, sir.
Let's take a couple of questions at a time. Let's see, the gentleman here. We have one outside. We'll go back, and then we'll come back around here. Okay. And if you could introduce yourself.
Roger Brown with Senator Leahy's office. I guess what in the last 2 or 3 years, what could the North have offered that would have made not 98% of the people in the South vote for separation?
Thanks. At the back, raise your voice.
Yeah, Jeremy Knighting from Mercy Corps. There hasn't been much talk about the three areas. I'm interested to know from any of the panelists what they're expecting to see in terms of the political developments and potential for instability in the three areas between the elections this year and the referendum.
Oh, what is it? I missed it. Three areas.
Sean Brooks with the potential for instability. And could you discuss the risk of seeing the election merely as a process to avoid war in 2011? I mean, it seems like if the political environment doesn't exist for free and fair elections, but the elections go forward anyway, that's going to legitimize political entities that lack this crucial connection with their people, and therefore potentially cause more conflict. And if that's the case, aren't the elections scheduled for just a couple of months from now really one of the last chances at taking a giant step forward in democratic transformation and getting at the root causes of conflict?
Let's take those, and then we'll come back for another round. So what could the North have possibly done to make unity attractive enough, is the first question.
You represent the North.
But it's your perspective that counts.
What can you offer me?
Well, as we said at the beginning, that the cause for the conflict was mainly socioeconomic development. and disparity in service delivery. I think the agreement, the CPA, provided for making Unit 2 attractive during this time through accelerated development of Southern Sudan reconstruction. And a number of programs had been identified to make Unit 2 attractive. Those included connecting the south or southern states with the northern parts. That is infrastructure. And so far, I haven't been to the south recently. I was there last April, but I didn't see much of it. Well, maybe I was traveling by plane, but those who have been in the south say there's no much connection, road connection, between the north and the south, except for one route that goes to Malakal, and it is not yet complete. The other part in the transportation field dealt with bridges across the Nile. And a number of bridges were foreseen across Malakal, I mean in Malakal, between Bor and Tarkaka, that is in southern Sudan, north of Juba, and on the Juba, around Juba. This, none of them has taken root. Other programs, including agriculture and projects that had been started long before the conflict, including the Melut sugar factory, for which the equipment had been transferred to some parts in the north, have not restarted. It has taken 5 years. And so economic development would have probably made 40% of the 98%, if I take Dr. Ezekiel's word, that 98% of the people from southern Sudan might vote for, or are likely 100% going to vote for separation, it might have reduced the percentage from 98 to something like 58, which could still be majority. So I think economic development would have been a factor. Now, there's also a crisis of confidence between the North and the South, between the NCP and the SPLM. Whatever is agreed appears not to be implemented. The border issue, the ABI, the ABI border, and even after the Permanent Court of Arbitration award, yet today there appears to be some talk about the difficulties in implementing the award. So I think I may be wrong, but these steps would have probably minimized the southern tendency towards separation. Thank you.
Yeah, national reconciliation would have been better. We have to reconcile, you know, as communities, because we have been fighting one another. We have been insisting in having this conference so that we can reconcile. I think most importantly is the mindset of the North toward the South is what is basically dividing the country. There has to be a change of mindset, you know, for the South to vote for a united Sudan. You know, the reason why South Africa is together is because the whites, they have realized that they have committed, you know, some you know, some of the things that they have done in South Africa, and then they have realized that they made mistakes, and then they really need to have this truth and national reconciliation in South Africa, and also providing opportunities for blacks to lead the country and unite the communities. But it is the opposite in Sudan. You can see Bashir, he wanted with the speech that he delivered the day before yesterday, he's trying to appeal to the southerners to vote for him so that he can continue to lead. I thought it should have been the other way around. You know, I have done enough. We are sorry. We have done bad things to the south. We want a southerner to lead us this time. Me, Bashir, I'm stepping down, and Salva, you take a lead. So that Salva can reconcile the communities and even provide development to the people of Southern Sudan and all the marginalized areas. That will actually appeal to many people, because it is not about just people are thinking it is religion and race. No, if we have been coexisting together, if people are, you know, treated fairly in Sudan, there is no need for us to have this country in pieces. So mindset of the North has to change. And, of course, economic developments in the South, and even stopping sponsoring militias, because they believe that they can continue to rule Sudan by creating instabilities in the South and also Darfur and other areas. Three areas it is a concern, especially, let me talk about only two areas, because Abyei, they are going to vote to be a part of the South. So you will actually be left with Nuba Mountains and Southern Blue Nile. There, the perception on the popular consultation is that we are going to decide if we are going to be part of the South or North. That's the interpretation that they are having about popular consultation. So they believe that they will be given a chance to decide if they are going to be part of the South or North. But popular consultation basically is actually having their own system, but they will continue to be a part of the North. So in their thinking, if the South is going to go, they will try to join the South. And that will be also seen by the North as a violation of the CPA, and then it can reignite the war between the two communities, the two areas and also the North. And then they will run into the South, and then definitely the South will be dragged into war. So I think really supporting the two areas is very important. And there is serious frustrations already about this South going. And possibility of two areas starting the war is there. I don't know if...
Any or all. I agree with what the ambassador was saying about the lack of investment in the South being a big disappointment to people in the South. Half of the oil revenues of South Sudan are returned to South Sudan, but there's been no attempt to have what you might call federal investment in Sudan, investment from the Government of National Unity's own resources in Southern Sudan, and that's been a big disappointment. But another thing is, I think, which it makes Southern Sudanese people, I think, justifiably impatient at the moment, is a lot of people are calling for an extension of the interim period, wait for, you know, put off the referendum. But Northerners have not gone to visit Sudan. I mean, the NCP political leadership, the president has been how many times? Three times. President Bashir has visited Southern Sudan three times. But even Northern intellectuals who see in the SPLM a cause for hope for transformation of their own part of the country don't go and visit. They don't engage. They don't work together. And one of the things I was trying to say in the report is that alliances seem to be very difficult to make in Sudan. And that's also, that happens across the Horn of Africa as well, that you've got lots of people with shared interests, but they can't seem to make alliances. And one of the reasons for that is that the central state has ruled in such a divisive way. And I think this particular government, at the outset of its rule, chose an especially divisive approach to ruling, revolutionizing Sudan, getting rid of existing mechanisms for holding at least northern Sudan together, and supplanting them with its own cadres and institutions. And that's made it very hard for people to work out ordinary politics and and you know, kind of come to local solutions. And I think that's one of the problems in the three areas. I mean, it would seem to me as a non-Sudanese that the Misariya people in Kordofan and the Nuba people in Kordofan, southern Kordofan, have a lot in common. The Rufa'al Hoy people, who are an Arabic speaking group of Blue Nile, and the African language speaking groups of the Blue Nile, of which there are several, they have a lot in common. They're all marginalized, they're not very well off. They all have to travel long distances to get work in cities where they're kind of seen as hicks or worse than hicks, you know, like cheap, dirty labor kind of thing. So they face a lot of similar problems, but they have within them the memories of this war, and their wars were just as full of rape and murder and burnt villages as the better known war in Darfur. So when I say that national reconciliation is important, I'm not just speaking therapeutically. You need to have a political structures in Sudan that encourage alliances between groups that have been set at odds with each other for years and years and years. And I think that's what this year needs to be seen as, an opportunity to move Sudan in that direction and away from a very coercive and divisive form of rule. It's not easy, and it's certainly not something that will be achieved within 12 months, but that needs to be one of the things that people have in mind when they're looking at Sudan in the year ahead.
I think
the elections do have a, for me, and I think it would be very good to have the views of the Sudanese panelists on this, because I'm an outsider. But I mean, for me, I think one of the most important parts of the elections, I think many people seem to believe that the presidential elections, for example, are a foregone conclusion in both North and South Sudan. I think you have to remember that just about every post in Sudan, or indeed every post in Sudan, is filled by an appointee. Every legislative post and every political post is filled by an appointee. And they're appointed by, nearly all of them are appointed by SPLM or NCP. And I think having changes of governors, changes of state legislators, southern Sudanese legislators and so forth, those people will get a little bit of authority from having a constituency backing them. They won't be able to be shifted around so much. You see, I think in the last week, a lot of the northern governors were sacked, weren't they? I don't know how many.
Seven
was it? Yeah. And you won't be able to do that when there are elected governors. It's not that the elected governors will be probably in many cases the same governor, but they will just have a different power relationship upwards from what they have at the moment, and they'll have to listen a bit more carefully downwards than they have to do at the moment. And the elections are another set of elections which won't happen until these elections are the very local, the Payam level elections, which is the smallest administrative unit. And those are very important elections as well, because remember that's a part of Sudan, especially in peripheral areas, that's a part of Sudan where people have been thoroughly abused and structures have been thoroughly abused, so that local organizations have been oriented towards the military objectives of faraway elites. Now, the process of changing those people with people that have some support from the local community will be very important in starting to establish peace. But it's not an immediate answer by any means, but it's an important departure for me. They're not scheduled yet, or they are scheduled for after the national and state level elections, but without a specific date.
Let's take another round. Should we take another round? Okay.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, please. Yeah, please.
Yes, on the elections. There is fear expressed by many observers, national and international, that the elections may not be free and fair. But my government says with the presence of the international monitors, we are going to conduct a free and fair election. And the election, the process is not to avoid war. They are mandated by the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. Otherwise, the timing for this election, if it were not based on that mandate, could not have been necessary, because as people are going for the referendum in 1 year, this is a waste of resources, because after the referendum, there will be need to make another round of elections. So I don't think they are precisely for avoiding war, because even with the result, violence could still erupt. It has done so in Zimbabwe, in other places, in Kenya, next door. Legitimizing leaders, I don't know, no comments. Thank you.
Okay, yes, sir.
Reed Kramer from All Africa. There have been several references to the importance of the international community, the contribution that needs to be made, but could you be more specific? I mean, we have a letter this week from John Prendergast and the NEF Project calling for both intensified U.S. Involvement in Sudan and also a more vigorous coalition effort. What do you, the people on the panel, think can be done by the international community, and who needs to be engaged?
Others? Yes.
Most of what we talked about today in the way of possibility of conflict in Sudan has related to sort of strategic calculations on either side to go to war for a particular reason, either from the north or the south. I'd like to hear the panelists' views on the possibility of more junior officers, sort of a breakdown in command and control, resulting in conflict over any particular issues, and perhaps escalating to be something that resembles a calculated effort towards war. And so not only the possibility, but also what efforts, you know, either any parties in the country or in the region or internationally are taking to prevent that possibility.
Your name, please.
I'm Stephen Whittles from the Council on Foreign Relations.
Yes.
Thank you. I would start with the junior officers provoking some conflict, a breakdown in chain of command. This is a very high probability and risk that many people have not only alluded to, but that is seen in the South. Two years ago, in May 2008, the conflict in Abyei was a result of breakdown in the chain of command. And at any border area now, such a problem is likely to recur, especially where some communities want to come for grazing, but armed with modern weapons, whereas the state authorities do not allow that. So if such a thing happens, it will not be by the command of anybody, but a junior officer could simply just order and the conflict could start. And whether it is one or two people starting it, it might unfortunately engulf everybody. So this is a great possibility. Many people are working on trying to avert it, to prevent it. But yes, I'm not sure whether it can be prevented. Now, on election security, the police with the international monitors are working on providing security to the electoral process, the officers and the people in the boxes. What is the role of the Joint Integrated Units? I don't think, except for the Joint Integrated Police, units, which are part of the election security, but and which are under the UNAMID or the UNAMIS all over Sudan. They are working towards that. The Joint Integrated Army units have not worked as a unit. So I don't think they will be of any help. Otherwise, there could be a problem. The budget priorities in order to prevent conflict. Development in the periphery. Infrastructure, when it's not available and it can be funded through the national budget. The police even do not have cars to transport them. There are no roads. So if the national budget was targeted towards delivering services, probably that would have helped in reducing conflict and preventing violence. I will leave room for my other panelists to answer questions.
I will just try to say something about international community. I think now the focus of the international community, instead of leaving it to the U.S. and its special envoy Gration, the same team must come back again, like what we used to have from 2002 to 2005, because the effort of the international community at that time is what translated into the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. For us to make sure that this is going to arrive safely in 2011, the same body must come back again and really engaged in the post-2011 arrangement and the rest of the things that are not implemented with big force, the IGAD country, the Troika, the UN, the Arab League, all of them needs to come back again. Otherwise, what they have done in helping having the CPA signed will actually go in vain. We have to really have the same effort, seriously. Nobody in Southern Sudan will attempt, junior officers, will attempt to create anything else or have coup or rebel to go and fight. This one will happen after 2011. If the referendum is extended and the leadership continue to dialogue with the NCP leadership and the referendum time has gone, then all those who are actually frustrated definitely will not allow this to go. The extension of the referendum is actually seriously endorsing anybody to declare war on the North. This is going to be the case, but not now. Everybody in Southern Sudan is saying, oh, let us pray 2011. Don't even quarrel. I don't want you to even say anything about it. 2011, January 9th, that's it. Anything after that is possible. But it is possible in the North. Because if Bashir is being seen like, okay, now you are handing over the South to the Southerners, any junior officer in the North will say, no, that's it, you out. And then the war will start again. It is possible in the North, but not in the South. It will be possible in the South after 2011. Issue of conflicts in the South. The SPLM is trying to really help in disarming, even though the North is rearming, but we are trying to have community reconciliations and dialogue. And this is why we need to be helped, because the police is very weak and the SPLA is not mandated by the Constitution to do that. Finally, the priorities. Now we have no time even to talk about infrastructure and building this and building that and building, because we have only 1 year left. I think, to me personally, if I can be the one, you know, deciding how the budget can be prioritized, I would be focusing on agriculture for the communities to have food in 2011. And then I would be focusing on making sure that the security in the South is stable. And then I will try to make sure that roads are somehow constructed so that you can transport food from community to communities. Thank you.
Oh, wow. Well, I think, unfortunately, I've got to answer the nationality question. I think all of the other ones have been answered. unfortunately, because I'm not an expert on it at all, and I don't know. I think it's a really important question. I think that one of the problems with the constitution of South Sudan's definition of a southerner, for me, as an outsider, I feel that it's got some very precise elements and it's got some very vague elements. So you could say that everybody in Sudan is a southern Sudanese based on the fact that nearly everybody has some kind of descent from somebody who was from southern Sudan. And that's for a very sad reason, which is the slave trade of the 19th century. Now, try Ireland, somebody has written, and that was what I was going to get onto next as a citizen of that country. Yes, that seems like a very good one. I'm an Irish citizen. I'm actually a British citizen as well now. But if I were just an Irish citizen, I could do anything in the UK apart from work in the security services. I think I'd have more rights than a European citizen would do. So I think the British were able to give that to the Irish partly because they were in a position to be generous with a much smaller and weaker country. And I don't think that the Northern Sudanese feel that they are in that position to be generous with a bigger and more threatening country that South Sudan would be. Before Yugoslavia, before Yugoslavia broke up, there was a nationality law that sounded very sensible at the time, but clearly didn't contribute to a solution. And one of the elements of that law was that you could choose, that you defined your identity. There's a real risk that it won't go that way. And I think that's one of the things that's really important in a nationality law, that it's the state does not tell you who you are, because you might want you really have to work that out for yourself. I think, and there was one other situation, but I can't quite remember which one it was.
We had the lower rank breakdown in the lower ranks, the international.
Oh, right, yeah, okay. You want me to go through all of those?
No,
all right. International contribution. Well, I think in unstinting support for financial support for the election and the referendum. I mean, it's going to be very difficult to hold the referendum because the Referendum Act has just been adopted. It took 8 months from the adoption of the Elections Act for the Electoral Commission to be operational in Sudan. And the Electoral Commission will be at the peak of its busyness when the referendum commission starts its work, if it gets formed within the next few weeks. Lots and lots of people who are working on a similar process, the electoral process, won't be available to work on the referendum. So running two operations at once is going to be really taxing for the Sudanese, and I think it's important that resources are available for that. Beyond that, I think Sudan needs to listen to and engage more with the region. The region, the Horn of Africa, presents many sort of stark warnings about the way things can go wrong, but it also has possibilities for getting things right. Sudan isn't, one of the complexities about Sudan is it's not just in the Horn of Africa, it's also sort of in the Middle East, and it's sort of in the Sudanic Belt of Africa, and sort of in the Great Lakes Basin. So it's affected by all of the conflicts in all those areas. But I think that, like, one of the routes to perhaps solving the nationality puzzle is to look at something like the Four Freedoms Agreement with Egypt, which is supposed to allow Sudanese and Egyptians the right of residence, work, ownership, and something else in each country. There's also the East African Community, which allows visa-free travel. There's IGAD has some work on pastoralist movements. I mean, these are not like
wonderfully successful projects at the moment, but in a way they're something that you could listen to and learn from and orient yourself towards, rather than this belligerent posturing over, you know, whether we're going to send them all back kind of thing, which I think is just a terrifying threat to make, and not one that people have even begun to grasp in Khartoum. Is that okay, or you want more?
I think
we got some very interesting answers from the ambassador and from Dr. Ezekiel, and I think they covered it much better than I could.
No, thank you all three for really thoughtful comments and for the great questions coming from here. I don't know if you're able to stand around. I'm sure you'll be mobbed as soon as we let you go. But please join me in thanking the panelists, and hope to have you back.